Bob, a recurring challenge I'm seeing with my customers is technical debt. And I think the thing I'm going to tell them first, you might not like. I tell them, that's okay. This is normal. This is part of your journey. How do you feel about that?
I think I agree with you. Not.
Oh, dang it.
No, not.
Oh, okay, good.
No, I mean, I half agree with you. I think it's like a pay me now, pay me later. I think of technical debt as pay me now, pay me later. And it's very contextual, and we're going to get into it, I'm sure, Josh. You know, there's a lot of context or situationalness around it. But I think, you know, if you're saying it's normal to have technical debt because you're building something new and you're competing, then I would be a little contrarian to that, to say I still always feel like build it right the first time.
I'm talking about like large amounts of technical debt, not like, oh, hey, we got this little thing over here in the corner, but something, our primary application that runs our business or is the product that we sell to customers is just riddled with technical debt. And my most common response is, yes, I understand. That's normal. Now, and that doesn't mean we stop there, because they feel paralyzed. They can't innovate. They can't do whatever.
And I would say, shame on you.
Ooh, would you?
I would say, shame on you, you pointy-headed bean counter. You shortchange. You rushed to market a little bit, and you made some bad trade-offs. I wouldn't quite be that obnoxious, maybe. But I would say, you know, that's you did that to yourself. And just like you did it to yourself, going forward, you can undo that. You can stop doing that a little bit, right? You can be prudent.
Yes. To follow up my statement, I certainly lean into the same thing that you do. Like, okay, cool. We're here now. You likely had to make choices in the past to get to market, to acquire customers, that if you hadn't made those choices, the company might not exist right now. So let's accept those as those were decisions that were made. A lesson that I've learned over the years of coming into situations like this, maybe it's not a lesson, it's a belief that I have, is that every decision was right when it was made. The people that were working on this 5 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever, did the best thing they could. And based on the information that they had, they made the best decision that they could. It's easy for us to Monday morning quarterback 2 years, 5 years later and say, man, that was really dumb. Like, why in the world did you do that? And you know what? I bet those people are saying the same things to themselves. But that doesn't change where things are right now. So that's where I spend a lot of my time. Like, step one for me is just getting over it. It's like when I was going through a divorce and my lawyer, the first thing my lawyer said to me is like, listen, the sooner you get over the fact that half of your retirement savings is gone, the better you're going to be. So just stop your whining and get over it. So I brought that tactic with me as I coach some of the companies that I'm working with. They're in a situation where like, holy cow, we're going to have to spend a lot of money to get out of this. Yes. Let's not whine about it. Let's not just like live in that forever. Let's accept that that's a reality and let's start moving forward. So to me, that's step one with tech debt is like, yes, we have a problem. Yes, it's sizable. But more importantly, yes, we're going to do something about it.
See, I agree with you in the get over it, but I disagree with you on the it's inevitable, right? I don't think it's inevitable. I mean, I think there's maybe okay tech debt. And then I think there's tech debt where people made bad decisions. You know, they let time force, I'm going to characterize it this way, and you may disagree with me, but time forced us to do crappy engineering. So Medicasters, look at me. I grew up in a time where I got a software engineering degree and the quality of your engineering mattered. I'm not right. So engineering and design and doing things well, not perfectly, not gold plating, but thoughtful design. And if someone said, Bob, I need you to slap that stuff together and get it out the door, I'd be like, no, I need some time. We can minimize the feature set, but I'm not going to do crappy work. So I think there's technical debt we misdesigned. We misunderstood the market. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about crappy engineering related to rushing to judgment, right? Making shortcuts in engineering, in design, in testing, in architecture, in UX. And I say that that's not inevitable. I think the leaders probably didn't listen to their teams. I think there's an offset to that, not just the business dynamic, Josh, and I'm going to shut up in a sec to see how you react, but I think it affects the morale of the team. It doesn't empower the team. They feel like they have to do crappy work, or however you want to couch it, right? They're not doing really good development work because of some reason. I don't know if that's inevitable. So I like to settle down, look yourself in the mirror and say, we got it. Let's move forward. But I think you should reduce the inevitability of that going forward and change your mindset about how you make those decisions. Any reactions?
I 100% agree about the morale. The number of companies I've come in to help and morale is low because the engineers feel like they're just mired in this debt. They're never going to get out. No one listens to them. Everything you just said, 100% true. The good news I have for them is like, hey, I wouldn't be here if the company wasn't ready to invest and make these changes. So that's good news. And that starts things going in the right direction. One of the challenges that I learned as a leader from one of my engineers that was actually brought up a really great point is we often as engineers use the word right. This is the right thing to do. This is the right way to do it. And the definition of right over time, as your company evolves, it changes based on the context. I 100% agree that you should build it as architecturally solid as possible from the beginning. I'm not suggesting that you just, if you're starting a company, you just slap stuff together. I'm not suggesting that at all. What I am suggesting is that there may be a time when you have to make a decision about, do I make this as perfect as I would like, or do I need to get it out the door and get feedback back? And then as we have validation, I think there's some agility that leans into this whole thing of a lot of times and a lot of challenges that I hear from leaders is the engineers aren't operating in an agile manner. It's like, it's all or nothing. We can only do this right if we start from scratch and do it all over again, as opposed to how do we iterate and evolve to a better place. And so that's where I have some challenges. Everybody wants to build the best thing. Everybody wants to be proud of the work that they do. People pour everything they have into these products and they want to be proud. They want to go home and feel like, yes, like I did a good thing. And I think, and I believe that 99% of the developers that are out there do that. Where that conflict starts is from a leadership side of not having that full clarity, the full context of what right means to us now. Doesn't mean it can't change, doesn't mean it won't evolve, doesn't mean it won't be different, but it does change. And if you get to a point where you're hiring me to come in, like now's the time to like, let's like, we're going to buckle down and we're going to get this darn thing like as architecturally sound as possible, because it's time. We're going to scale the crap out of this. Yep. We're going to get a bajillion customers and it's got to be ready for that.
Hey, Josh, do you have stairs in your house?
Stairs?
Yeah.
Yes, Bob,
they're,
I do.
They're a little rickety. I think I remember you saying they're rickety. You're going to get them redone, right? So I could do it in balsa wood. Do you know what balsa wood is?
I do. I've made little model airplanes out of them.
So I can build it out of balsa, right? And you want it in balsa. So I can redo the entire staircase in a day in balsa wood. And Elmer's glue. Real pretty easy thing. But the engineer in me says oak, 2x4s, 2x6s. Particularly because of weight bearing.
Wow. Okay. All right. That's how it's going to be. All right. I see.
Right. Because I don't think balsa is going to do the job. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is proper engineering. There's a place where you can push by time, right? So there is perfectionism in engineering. And I think a lot of leaders react to that. But the counterpoint is there's proper, and I think today's software engineers maybe don't get proper, you know, we've slapdashed things together for a long time, or we've been over prototyping or over incrementing. And I think a lot of folks don't know what solid engineering is as a baseline. So coming back to the stairs, I think Balsa is not an option, no matter. I think, and I'm not poking at your weight, a little bit, but what I'm saying is no, it's like, oh, I'll iterate and I'll figure out what works. No, I don't want you to fall through the Balsa and kill yourself in order to have an aha moment to say, well, that experiment didn't work. Right. I should have listened to the engineers, you know. Now maybe we can cut corners in some places, or maybe we cannot trim it out the way we would. Right. Maybe we have a mocked up railing. I know it's a stretch, but I'm trying to anchor on not perfect, not right, but well engineered, right? And I think a lot of technical debt has an underlying, we pushed beyond well engineered, we poorly engineered it, and that's I think what I'm really struggling. I say we need to change that as well. What did that make sense? What did that add to the conversation, or was I too balsified?
My tongue-in-cheek response is, well, if you can really slap it together in 5 minutes, then I can try it. And if the first step works,
then jump up those stairs, my friend. Go ahead.
I get what you're saying, and I do agree. And just thinking back about what you're saying, a majority of the projects that are out there aren't built well. Would you say that in your travels of companies you've come into or companies you've helped, that most of the products are built as like quality software and like you can really rely on that?
No, I think that's why I'm harping on it. I think there is under, and I think it's gotten worse, right? And I'm not saying we had crappy software 30 years ago or something, but there's a lot of bad engineering in the world that I see that contributes to the technical debt. And it's not just leaders putting pressure on the team. That's a part of it. It's also maybe capabilities of the team. In order to do that, there's multiple dynamics, but I think that's what I'm poking at, is that's have a solid baseline. Even if it's well engineered, if you scale the system beyond it, you're still going to have to maybe re-architect the system, but you have this strong baseline. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and he's a general manager in a company that they have a platform. I forget what they do, but there's an Israeli part. So they were acquired, and the Israeli company acquired the U.S. company. They do similar things. The Israeli company has 5 to 10 outages daily. So software as a service. And my friend in the U.S. and who's applying Agile and refactoring and things like that, they've gotten it to the point where there's no. The last time they had an outage was, they have an outage maybe once a month or twice a month. Mm-hmm. And there's just this, I think there's this sort of rigor of engineering that's a difference, and practices and things like that. And obviously they're reducing technical debt as well. And so speed over here or whatever. But what I'm saying is same market, same dynamics, and you have instability, which is killing, you know, customer experience. And then you have stability. Now they have many more customers, so they're more viable from a marketing point of view, but there's still this underlying engineering disconnect. And they're just starting to try to figure out, well, what are you guys doing? How can you have no outages? You know, what kind of a question is that?
And you identified what I believe to be a key driver in how we landed here as an industry. you know, a craft, whatever it is that the less well architected, the less stable product acquired more customers. That happens for a handful of reasons. A very common pattern that I've seen is that the founders or leaders of those companies are not engineer based. So they didn't grow up as an engineer. So they don't fully grasp the decisions that are made around like, hey, let's get this thing out. Now they also have the opposite side of the coin is that they have a much higher skill at getting things into market, launching, selling, doing all that stuff. So that combination creates a situation for many companies that I've been a part of or seen or helped. And the opposite, exactly what you said, the one that got acquired is that more stable, didn't get customers as fast, but was built like a freaking rock, yep. Right? And so now what happens is those two things are going to come together, yep. And you'll have the best of both worlds. You'll have that dynamic, strong sales and marketing engine paired with that dynamic, strong product, and then really good things are going to happen. But what happens is so many companies go that path and succeed very well with getting things in the market, and someone like me comes in, looks under the covers. He's like, holy crap, how is this thing like working? Like, how have you, exactly. How have you made this last for so long? And yep. It is kind of amazing. But also realization is hit everybody square in the face, because what usually happens is you're starting to get worried about your place in the market because yep. You can't innovate as quickly as the smaller guys or whatever it is, because you're dealing with those outages, or to add a relatively simple feature costs a whole lot of money, exactly. Because of all the technical debt they're trying to wade through. So both are right, both are wrong. But ultimately what needs to happen, what doesn't happen enough, which is what I'm hoping that we can drive with this episode, is that you need to get that excellence on both sides that I just talked about, that excellence of a sales driven leader and company paired with the excellence of that engineering led group, and like unify and become one. Too often those paths become very contentious and they don't have the difficult conversations that are required to get to the spot where the aha light goes on. And where I'm coming from with all of the angles that I've said in this episode is, as leader, say you're a leader of a successful company, one of the challenges that I see that prevents engineering teams from having those discussions is a leader's capability to explain the context of the business and how it works and how everything we do like makes money and pays for salaries and does all that. And I found that when you truly educate engineers with all of that info, they are equipped and they are what I call commercially minded. And so now they can make the right choices. They understand the give and the take, and they really are not gold plating, but they're also not just slapping stuff together. So my goal, my drive for any leader that's listening to this, that's starting to wrestle with technical debt, is, have I done a good enough job as a leader, as a non-technical leader, to ensure that my engineering team and arm really understands, yep. How all this fits together as a business? Yep. And that's the most common issue that I see. There are plenty of other issues that are on the other side of the house from the devs and the engineering that we can talk about, but that's why I'm coming at it from the angle that I am.
Does the term MVP, so I always thought a minimal viable product, in my mind, that was an ask for this balancing act, Josh. So to me, mm-hmm. MVP was, you know, an acronym to sort of hit the middle. I want something that's well crafted, but fast, and so that we can get it out there. Does that have the same connotation to you, or?
It does to me, but not enough to business leaders that are out there.
Okay.
There are too many times where an MVP gets into market too quickly.
Yeah.
And there were decisions that were made intentionally because this is an MVP and we expect to, like, okay, if we validate that this has legs within the market, we're going to be able to shore it up and come in and give it the girders we didn't give or whatever. And too often it's like, it gets pushed over that hill and then it's off to the races and the engineers are running after it, like with their hands out, trying to catch it, and it's gone. And so then that's where the technical debt really ramps up.
Yeah. There was another thing you said, and I want to just touch on it. Balance. You were talking about the balance, and I think it's building the balance in. So for example, and I think you can probably have seen this, if we're leaning into the getting things out quickly, well then, and I've created a team that can do that, I can talk about creating well-engineered products, but I may not have people who understand what that even looks like. So now if I want to rebalance back, I need a guy like Josh Anderson to come in and not just give me consulting advice, but maybe like hire some people or whatever to rebalance. And that can take a lot of effort to do that. So I'm talking about the skill thing. Or on the other side, dinosaur developers like me who maybe are good at well crafting can't move quickly, right? They're very uncomfortable with that. So I think one of the critical things is, no matter which way you're leaning, is building a balanced team along the way, so that if you need to pivot a little bit, you can do it. You don't have to retrain or rehire your whole staff. Any reactions to the skill set sort of dynamic?
Yeah, one of the things that you and I have talked a lot about is technical leadership and how it's absent in many spots. And we believe it's absent because most technical folks don't end up in an organization where there's a technical leader that they can like aspire to be or model themselves after. I believe the same thing holds true about that architectural greatness.
Yeah.
Not many engineers have had an opportunity to see a really well built, really well constructed piece of software to like start to model things after and say, like, okay, cool. So now's the time for us to buckle down and we're going to, you know, really support this with a new architecture or whatever it is. Unfortunately, not many people have that in their experience, in their background, to say like, aha, I know what good looks like. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to make it. It's like, okay, cool. Let me go like watch some YouTube videos and try and figure out what company XYZ did. And then maybe we'll copy it from them. And hopefully that works.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, because of, as we've talked about, and as the things I've said about the successful companies often don't have well-architected software where there's a lot of engineers, maybe they need more engineers because it's not architected well. So it takes more time and effort and energy. So therefore you like live in this mire of tech debt. So now it's all you know. And how do you learn how to get out of there? And you need someone with experience to come in and help just grow the team and the capabilities and skills to get that done.
That's a rare breed. I mean, just like everyone's a natural coach, but there's very few good ones. Everyone's sort of a software architect, but there's very few good ones. Didn't you had someone, for example, at the Dude, I think there was an architect there. He got a PhD or something. I forget his name, but the point is he was an architect. So to me, he struck me as an architect. He understood business. He understood technology. He was always learning. He was leading those. I mean, I think that would be a key, is get yourself, you know, to fight technical debt, get yourself one of those. You don't need 100 of those folks, but you need, even in a big company, and make sure you have one that's a good one, not someone who's, like you said, who's looked at a couple of YouTube videos and can talk the talk, but they can walk the walk.
Yeah. Okay. So we've talked about all of the reasons that we get here. Let's talk about navigating out of it. And so many of the challenges that I see people run into is it does feel like an all or nothing thing. And what I've said to engineer after engineer, to, you know, director, manager, anybody on the technical side that has like said over and over again to their, you know, investor, CEO, CFO, the only way we can do this is if we like start from scratch, do it all over again. Like we just can't, like it's a waste of effort and energy and I tell them they're wrong. Because you are not going to get somebody to write however big of a check it is for you to stop the development on your current system that's exactly. paying the bills.
Exactly.
And just put it over to the side and say, we're going to ignore that. Or maybe we'll put a couple of people on there to like keep it alive, put it on life support or something like that. And then we'll go build this thing over here. And the reason I say that is it likely took you some number of years to build the thing yeah. that you have. So why do you believe it would take you less time, like significantly less time to do it again? Yes, you have some lessons learned, but still like you have 5 years of features and functionality that you put into that.
Have you ever sold that strategy, Josh? So I've been doing waterfall. I have decades, right? I couldn't sell that, re-architect the damn thing, you know, 35 years ago to anyone. I mean, I proposed it. I walked into dark mahogany rooms and said, you know, give me $8 gazillion and another team. And people look at me like I had 20 heads or something. And it's like, no, I don't know. I mean, it's almost engineers try to propose that strategy inevitably. And I know of very few places, business contexts where they've sold that. And when they did buy it, it never worked out because you have this another monolithic big thing that you're trying to create, right?
Yeah. I was just talking to somebody and they were talking about how the business side of the house wants to do a big bang and they want to release everything all at once. And I said, listen, big bangs cause big bangs. Like there's a reason it's called a big bang. Like there's going to be a big bang. It's not going to go smooth. So your capability to build that, launch it, everything that's required to get it out in the market smoothly, easily, effectively, without disrupting customers, blah, 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 blah. Like it's not going to happen.
Right.
So step one, we go back to,
can I say a step,
Josh?
Can I say this real quick? I would say find someone on the outside.
Yeah.
Get a Josh. Get someone like Josh. And I'm not saying that because of Josh. What's the word? I'm looking for a word where you're blind. You have a blind spot. You are in the trenches in your domain. There's all goodness. You know, you've been successful. You've deployed something. You're making tons of money. Maybe you're having some architectural technical debt. There's all goodness, but you can't see the flaws. You can't see the way, even if you have an internal architect, I would say step 1B is to go get an outside set of eyes. Now it's the right set of eyes, not one of these folks that watch YouTube videos or that have a McKinsey or whatever consulting pedigree, but someone who's really has a track record of re-architecting, recreating, sort of reframing systems and get the help, get them to come in and help you guide those that incremental strategy. Would you agree with that, Josh, or maybe
yes.
not?
No, I do wholeheartedly, because many people have the opportunity or the challenge to do that like once or twice in their career. So it's not a skill that you build up. There are folks that have chosen to go down the path and like have done this, you know, a half a dozen times, maybe more like I have. It's been rough and tumble, but it's put me in a position where I can come in and help companies navigate out of that, only because like I've had a ton of bumps and bruises and I've tried to do things certain ways and it hasn't worked. I've just learned and learned and learned. So it's like anything, any new skill you're trying to pick up. If I want to get better at golf, I'm going to go find a golf coach that has played a lot of golf and not only has played a lot of golf, but has coached a lot of people and helped them get better at golf. So if I want to do better, this is a skill that your team, your company doesn't have. And it's not your fault. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just up until now, you haven't decided to put effort and energy towards it. Well, you are now. So now go get a coach that's going to help you be successful at this new endeavor that you're likely going down for the first time. Don't be foolish and try and go about it all by yourself. That's a bad plan. The likelihood of ending up in the same spot is very high.
Yeah.
And again, that's if we look at Josh trying to get better at golf, if I just go grab some clubs and go out there and start swinging, and I look back in, 18 months, I'm not going to be that much better because I don't have the experience of how to get better at becoming a golfer. So I need somebody to come in and coach me along that path.
Oh, wait, Metacaster's advice 1C is not only get a Josh or get an outside perspective, but listen to them. Like, shut up and listen to them, right? Like, take their advice. Very often we're resistant. Oh, we can't do that. Oh, we tried that 20 years ago and it didn't work. So don't get an outside opinion if you're closed-minded, right? And you get someone good and then trust them. And, give listen to them and then co-create the future with them.
Yeah. So the piece, as I was thinking about this episode this morning before we started recording, people always talk about the house and, I have to rebuild the house and the foundation. You can only get a chance to do the foundation once and all the...
And balsa.
Yeah, that's what, what all the old folks talk about. It's like, oh, I got a house and, I need you. You can only build the foundation once. And, come on. I've heard that a bajillion times. Listen, you hit me with some sun and other, trigger words like that earlier today. So I'm firing back here, buddy. The analogy that I was thinking of, and there's projects that you see like this that are just absolute and complete head scratchers, is expanding a subway in a major city. There's a requirement of, hey, we've grown as a city, we've grown as a metropolis, and we now need to extend the subway that we have to do this. Or the old one that we have is breaking down, and it breaks down 5 times a month and people get stranded in the subway. That sounds scary. But we need to rebuild the subway. Okay, cool. We can't do that because there's a bajillion skyscrapers and all these things and kids going to school and people going to work and blah, blah, blah. We can't disrupt that. So we're just stuck. We're screwed. It's never going to happen. No, they get some insanely smart people that have done this before to map out how we're going to put a new subway in under Times Square. Like, people do things like that. Is it easy? Is it fast? No, but it can be done. So that's step one. Well, actually, step two. We already talked about step one, which I mentioned, is going and find somebody that's done this before that can help you navigate out of this. Step two is accepting that you have a lot of challenging work in front of you.
Yep.
If it was easy to navigate out of this, you already would have solved this problem, but this is a hard problem. So now we're going to have to go through the really hard work of figuring out how we're going to add this subway underneath this giant system, because that's what your software is. It's a giant system of things. It's the skyscrapers, it's the water pipes, it's the electrical, it's the internet, it's the kids, playing in the park, all those things that you have to replace or that need to continue doing their thing while the replacement happens. You have to build a strategy like that.
I think part of it also is simplification as well. So we built a subway, going with your metaphor, one way, but now can we do it any simpler? Like, can we standardize on tracks? Does that simplify the cars or something like that? Do we embed electrical in the tracks in some way? So that'll simplify rewiring in the future. Do we really need this width of the tunnel, or can we actually have narrower cars? Oh, that'll save us some time. So all I'm getting at is, and I think this is where leaders can really weigh in, is continuously not putting, date pressure or time pressure or re-architecture pressure, but simplification of requirements. Simplification of basic features. There's a lot of things that no one uses. I would almost want companies to continuously look at usage statistics of features and things like that. Not just when you're deploying a product, but continuously. And it's like, oh, we don't need, if you can trim out 30% of a product during a reframing or a re-architecture, then that's just savings. That's just simplification. So that's a part of it. I don't know if the architects do that. I think that's the business side. That's the founder side of things. working with clients and not just doing it one time, but continuously. You spend time putting pressure on your team. How about spending time on, can we simplify stuff? Any reactions to that, Jack?
There's a whole episode that we could do about the number of things that are launched that never get measured. They just get like jettisoned into the world.
Yeah.
And now we're supporting them forever.
Yeah.
At some cost with very little understanding about, like, does it get used? We get 85,000 calls about that thing, but like, we've never really built it up. So, hey, maybe people want to use it, but they can't. So, yeah, maybe that's an episode of just like how to effectively launch things into the ether and validate what you do with them. That's kind of we go back to the MVP. You start getting into that path of you get an MVP out there, and then what do? You have to measure. So one of the things, going back to the Subway piece, is for leaders out there, you have to accept it's going to take time for you to build that world-class Subway that you want, that you know that you need. So you have to accept all of the complexities and all of the challenges that are out there that your team is up against to try and make this a reality. And you need to celebrate. This is where not enough leadership celebration happens, of celebrate the little wins along the way of like, hey, we've replaced that track. Sure, it's only a quarter of a mile, but we've replaced that track. That's the first one that's going to enable us to put power in the track so we can spend, you know, $50 million less in electricity or I don't know what. But now all these things that are setting us for success in the future are starting to happen. And you need to identify that and celebrate that. And too often, a lot of these projects go uncelebrated. So therefore, they slowly lose investment over time, because the understanding of the value that's being delivered is lost. So number one, engineering leaders, you have to do a really good job of celebrating and explaining to the rest of the organization why this is a big deal and why this matters and what this is going to enable in the future. And then everybody else within the company, you need to celebrate and understand that, like, hey, we just strengthened the core thing that we do. That's a main piece of the main line that runs, you know, 25,000 cars a month. So we need to really celebrate. And that's a huge deal. Cool. So now next month, we're going to do another quarter mile or whatever it is. And that's where a lot of these efforts tend to languish and die off over time, because they aren't given appropriate visibility. And there's challenges on both sides with that. Number one, in translating the value to the customer that is created by this architectural reset or something, but also just like celebrating those things. Too many companies don't celebrate that.
Modern day software, last 10 years, and you're more tuned into apps and things like that than I am, Josh. And I'm going to use the term slapdash, right? It's slapdash engineering. We're leaning into the speed. What do you see? What's the leanage? I think my view, and again, it could be historical, I'm thinking there's a lot of slapdashery going on in order to chase markets and to get feedback and things like that. So if we want to give some advice, it would be lean into engineering a little bit, lean into trusting your teams a little bit, because this re-architecture stuff is a burden, right? It really is. It's a weight burden. It's a delay burden. It's intrusive. To your growth, et cetera. Am I being too harsh though? Do you think engineering is getting better or more, you know, sort of that balance? What do you observe in a general way?
I think engineer remains as it is, as it was, from like a core skill of engineering of how to do the job. I still believe there's high quality crafts people out there.
Okay.
Where we lack on the technical side of the house is education, validation, and really, as we talked about, having that balanced discussion with leadership.
That's
and having that's where the challenge is. And again, we go back to this pivot you and I did with this podcast about trying to lean into leadership more and more.
Yeah.
That's where I think this episode and other folks that are out here, they're talking about the same thing. I think we can start to turn that tide by educating folks on this is how you navigate that. So if you feel like you're stuck, if you feel like you're up against this technical debt, you can reach out to me. You can reach out to Bob. There's other people that are out there that like, this is what we do. This is what we've done. And we've helped people navigate this. Don't go it all by yourself, right? That's like challenge number one. But again, I think the challenge is there's not enough balanced discussion that's happening across the entire context of the business. And by the business, I mean the technical bits, the sales and marketing, the support, implementation, all of that stuff. Having a truly balanced discussion is those balance beams get way offset. And then once they're offset, we talked about that cart that takes off down that hill and you're chasing it forever.
Would it be fair to say, to kind of wrap this up, that technical debt is not a technical problem? It's a technical to business balance problem at the leadership level in organizations. And yes, it's been imbalanced historically. We need to rebalance it. That's what I'm getting a sense in this discussion. Are you with me?
Yeah, it's very difficult in both sides because, again, you think about the technical aspects of technical debt and there's some really difficult challenges and there's a reason that you're stuck. Again, I said it a couple of times during this, like if it was easy, you already would have done it, but it's not. So there's hard things and explaining hard things is hard. Understanding hard things is hard. So you add the complexity of like, we have this hard thing and I need to try and educate the rest of the company that we need to slow down and invest in this really hard thing.
Yep.
It's hard for me and many people to articulate the business value that's associated with that, but it's there. And I've worked through that a dozen times. I've helped a dozen plus companies learn how to frame their architectural work as this really delivers business value. And you know what? When you explain that to product managers or CEO or CFO or whoever it is that's trying to understand, there's going to be a light bulb moment like, yes, why would we not invest in that? The number of times that I've helped companies or teams or whoever it is, help them reframe the architectural work. And we finally push that over the edge and we're talking it through with the board or executives or whatever. The number of times that people have heard that and said, okay, I understand, but no, we're not going to do that.
Right.
Is zero. Every other time has been like, wait, holy crap. Are you telling me that if we do this, this happens and this happens, or if we don't do that, this is what's going to happen? Like, yes, please. Why have we not done this? Like, thank you. So it's not an unwillingness. It's a lack of information. The number of times we've talked about where these difficult discussions come up because there's a lack of information on one side. And so now you have to do the really hard work of closing the information gap. And then again, you get smart people in a room with the same data. Likelihood everybody lands on the same answer is very, very high.
So let's wrap this up. We've been wrapping up episodes with like, what is the elevator pitch for the episode from whoever's participating? Let me try to start it. Yeah. So what does leadership have to do with technical debt? Everything. Josh?
Okay. Let's see. Mine would be, you have technical debt, you're accumulating more every day, and that is not a fault of the engineers that are on your team. They are not bad engineers. They're not unskilled or unwilling to build a good product. It is a lack of alignment within your company. And you, as leaders, are responsible for making that happen.
Ooh. Yeah. So, from beautiful downtown Cary, North Carolina.
And from beautiful downtown Fuquay Varina, North Carolina.
I'm Bob Galen.
And I'm Josh Anderson.
Shake.
And bake.
Take care, y'all.